there is no other thing in my life that has been as reliable as poetry. And so because it is like deeply embedded in my life, I feel really grateful to have a readership. I feel really grateful to have this job. I get to teach young people. I love working with students. Like, I've worked with non-majors, I've worked with majors. You know, it's just like, I like working with undergrads. I think it's a really fun age stage of life and inquiry into self. And at the same time, when I sit down to write, it's not for any of that. It's just, oh, it's time to write. It feels like it's the release valve, or I want to make something. I want to go play.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past, where we invite an established writer to revisit a piece they wrote in their tender years. That piece may fill them with affection, regret, nostalgia, embarrassment, relief, delight, anguish, all of the above, or something else entirely. Every infant must take those early, brave, awkward steps when learning to walk. We writers must make our own early, brave, awkward efforts as we set out to master our craft. So let's travel back to that ancient time when we were bursting with hubris or scared to death, drunk with language or paralyzed by it, determined to become a writer or terrified that we didn't have the stuff. I'll show them, we thought. But what did we show, really, and to whom? Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past. I'm Stephen Lovely, director of the Iowa Young Writers Studio.
And I'm Lauren Haldeman, the senior editor at the Writing University.
And I'm Danny Colacci, director of the Magid Center for Writing. Actually, I'm not Danny Colacci. Danny is, he's not here. He's on maternity leave.
And that's fine.
Lauren and I are flying the plane alone.
It's cool.
With our amazing guest.
We're starting to realize we don't need Danny at all.
No, we need Danny, but we wish him well. He can't be here. He's home being a good father.
He had a baby.
I think you are, now that Danny isn't here.
Danny's not here, so I'm doing the introduction today.
And
you will see.
I'm looking forward to it.
So today we are excited to have Danica Kelly on the pod. Our schedules in this town are so erratic, but you've been on our dream list for a while for guests, and now it's happening. Danica Kelly is the author of three poetry collections: Bestiary, which won the Cave Canem Poetry Prize, selected by Nikki Finney, as well as The Renunciations and her newest forthcoming collection, The Natural Order of Things. Kelly teaches creative writing at the University of Iowa, and I can't believe how lucky we are to have her in town. I am heavily invested in the actual soul of Iowa City, and we are just overwhelmed with gratitude to have Kelly's mind and heart and poetry existing in the ether here. You can just feel everything getting better. Danica's next book, The Natural Order of Things, coming this fall, is described as such. Kelly's poetry is known for its resonant, unflinching confrontations with trauma and inheritance, translated through myth and nature. The Natural Order of Things expands these explorations into a new realm, one defined by joy and connection. It is an ode to companionship with people, animals, and our planet, and reveals the reparative power of intimacy. Personally, I love how Danica's verse makes me slow way, way down. I don't fully know how she is doing this, because I am generally so impatient. But her work convinces the reader to read at her pace, a settled, unnervingly calm pace, and rewards the reader with a haunted wisdom. There is an insistence to the immediacy of each word. They make up a measured march through meter towards the unsettling, the revealing, the auspicious, the bold. And also, there are animals. Yay! Animals! Danica's animals and beasts are as woven into the consciousness of the work as the speaker herself. It is my kind of company. And one last thing. Danica is so good at bowling.
I don't think that's... I think I'm very medium at bowling.
I'm
a very medium bowler.
To me, you seem like a professional bowler.
Have you... Sorry, I don't want to interrupt.
We went bowling and Danica was so good at it.
Have you bowled with professional bowlers?
No.
It's really different.
Okay. Well,
not quite the same, I don't think.
She owns her own bowling ball.
That's true.
And it's the kind of bowling ball that's like a little sparkly in a way that you can't understand or decipher. A mystery for you to enjoy and trust, just like her poetry. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome, Danica.
So happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. It's great to meet you. I can't believe I haven't met you before, but it's a thrill.
We're pretty siloed. it feels like.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Not the students. The students just move.
They do. Like fluid.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah.
It's
yeah.
Partly my job, maybe, at the Reading University to get us all to get along.
Well, here we are.
I mean, yeah.
I know, right?
Yeah.
I did it.
And you've worked very hard to make that happen against, you know, against,
yeah.
Those silos are strong.
It sometimes feels like family therapy, but especially when you get all the programs in one room.
Oh, my God. Have you gotten all the programs in one room? Okay.
I'm supposed to do it once a year.
Yeah.
And once a year is too much to handle.
Well, maybe you could come to the next meeting that we have.
Yeah, okay.
It would be lovely to have you there. Yeah.
Sounds great.
Well, we like to do, on Sad Me of the Past, we like to sort of time travel.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of go back to the beginnings of writing for writers that have made it, and they're publishing, and they're being a writer in the world.
So, Danica, maybe we can sort of along those lines travel back to your sort of early days, and maybe you can give a sense of like when you started writing or when you started taking whatever steps you may have taken at the early age towards writing, whether that was reading or observing or sort of how did it all start for you and where were you? And
yeah, so this is a great question. One I knew to be prepared for it, and yet, what is the timeline?
It's a big question.
Okay, so I would say that I definitely started as a reader, and I was a big reader of fiction, and especially like from the time I was a kid, I always read back. So as I got older, I would still like revisit the books that I enjoyed when I was younger. So I still love picture books. I'm not interested in new picture books. I like the picture books that I read when I was a kid.
Like which ones?
What comes to mind immediately are a number of Stephen Kellogg's illustrated children's books. I really like his illustration style.
Yeah.
The Day Jimmy's Boa Ate the Wash. I don't think he wrote that one. I think he just did the illustrations for that. But he also did there was a series about Pinkerton, who was a big Great Dane. And I think maybe the first book was like A Rose for Pinkerton.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I liked Frog and Toad. I really, really loved Amelia Bedelia.
So what's Amelia Bedelia?
Amelia Bedelia is like an early reader book. So like they're early chapter books.
Yeah, how do you describe
it? And Amelia Bedelia is a literal person. So she works as a maid, but she is literal. So there are two moments that still stay with me. And the first was the people she worked for asked her to draw the curtains.
Yeah.
And she drew them like on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Which is like great because I had never heard anyone say draw the curtains before. It's like, so I was a kid in LA and we lived in Compton and this was the 80s and 90s. And so like no one was drawing the curtains. Like that wasn't a thing. And the other one was to dress the chicken.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. And she put clothes on the chicken.
Right.
And I was just like, this is great. Amelia Bedelia is wonderful. Mrs. Piggle Wiggle. Was it? What was the name of this book? It's like Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, which was like definitely a like YA chapter book. I had like some really great teachers. I had really, really wonderful teachers when I was in at every level. But I was in school districts for the most part that were not well funded when we lived in California. But I had really wonderful teachers, one of whom saw a lot of potential in me and got me tested for gifted and talented. I ended up going to a magnet school for 2 years. That was hard in a way that I did not enjoy.
Right.
Yeah.
There were like so many things that we got to do. There were so many things that were really wonderful about it. I had a bunch of stuff going on personally that made that challenging. But also it was the first time that I wasn't like the smartest kid.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And what grade was that?
So fifth and sixth grade.
Okay.
I did. Yeah. And so it was rough. I was like, but I'm smart. And I was like, not as smart as these kids. And so, but also like I had some stuff happening, as I said, at home.
Right.
And that was creating a lot of stress and anxiety. But that school, which was called Ambler Elementary School, was much better resourced. We took trips to Cal State Dominguez Hills, which was a college in the Cal State system. So California has like their university system is tiered. And so there's like the UC system and then there's the Cal State system. And I was like, I've been to Cal State Dominguez Hills. That is where I will go to college.
Right.
You know. But, and I was generally speaking a good student, but after we did our promotional exercise out of the sixth grade, I had the option to continue in the magnet program or go back to what I called regular school. And I wanted to go back to regular school.
Yeah.
Which I don't know is like, I mean, I was a kid. That wasn't a great choice probably. But I had really great teachers at the junior high that I went to. And they were very encouraging. I think they similarly saw a lot of promise in my writing. But I did not like to write.
Oh.
I hated writing.
No way.
I was like, it was horrible.
Well, what were they making you write?
It was just like whatever they had kids write. I don't remember. I just like didn't like to do it, like any part of it. I was like, this is stupid and I hate it. And they were like, you're good at it. And I was like, so?
So when you went back to left the magnet system and went back to the public schools, I assume it was a public school, was that like a social kind of a decision? Like was it like you wanted to go back to your friends or did it have something to do with community or just...
I think what my life has borne out is that I don't like when things are hard.
Well, right.
Like, I just don't like
it. Who does? Yeah.
There are some people who like to rise to the challenge and, you know.
Exactly the same way.
And I don't like to.
And the pressure, like I do not do well under pressure. And I remember, too, like the gifted and talented program, like all of a sudden there were like expectations and it was a weird form of being watched. You know, when you said that, I was like, nope, I know exactly.
Oh,
like,
okay.
It's not like wanting the easy path, but it's just like, I don't know. Like, you watch Caitlin Clark, right, playing basketball, and like, she is under so much pressure, and she seems fine, even seems to do better with it. And that's so not like how I am, and I imagine how you were too. Yeah. Like,
yeah, I don't like the extra pressure. So okay, so. But what is interesting, I think, is that – so after middle school, we moved to Arkansas. And my mom's family is from Arkansas. Both of my grandparents – both of her parents are from the same area in the southern part of the state. So we moved there. And this would have been the late 90s. And what was – there were many things that were interesting about going to Arkansas. I really liked it. The school just had more funding.
Yeah.
What grade were you in again?
So this is high school. So ninth grade through.
I mean, funding makes a big difference.
Yeah. Funding makes a big difference. And you wouldn't expect that like a school in Arkansas, in southern Arkansas, which is not a rich part of the state, would have more funding than a school in California. But I was in the Compton Unified School District, which was like severely underfunded.
Right.
And so I had really, really wonderful teachers. My dad, who is a terrible person, but who has done some really wonderful things for me. One of the things that he encouraged me to do was to take AP classes.
Mm-hmm.
What I appreciated about that is I didn't have to take all of the AP classes.
Yeah.
I could just take some of the AP classes. I wasn't interested in taking the AP test or getting college credit because I wasn't thinking about college.
Right.
No one in my family was thinking about college. My mom has some college, but that wasn't a path that was sort of obvious or expected. And so I was just in AP classes to be in AP classes. So I took AP English, AP Science, Biology, and Anatomy and Physiology.
Wow.
And then all the AP math, which was the worst.
Wait, like, you were in AP math?
I thought you didn't like hard things, doing the hard things.
I know, but it's like once you get on the track with the math, it's kind of hard to kind of like pop out of the track.
Yeah.
And so I was just like on the advanced math track, which was unfortunate.
It's
impressive, yeah.
It's surprising, but not – I feel like poets have kind of mathy brains.
Sure. I mean, sure. I don't know. I was fine at math. I was not great at math. I was fine.
You were in AP math.
So. I was, but I wasn't, like, strong.
Yeah.
But I was in AP. I was in there.
You were in there, though.
I was able to follow along, but I didn't understand anything that was happening conceptually. I think people who are good at math have some kind of innate conceptual understanding of –
Yes.
They understand the numbers on a different level. And I was like a journeyman. You know, I was just like in there, just like plugging the
work.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, it worked for you.
It was fine. It was fine.
Yeah.
But my English teachers were really, really amazing. They were astonishingly generous with us and with me. And in the 10th grade, one of my 10th grade English teacher asked us to write a poem. And I wrote a poem, but she just wanted us to go around and read it. And I started crying.
Oh, man.
Like, I was just like crying and crying and crying. And
Was it?
She still made me read it, which I think is interesting.
It is interesting.
She was like, "No, but read it," and I was like, wow. "Okay." And I was like crying and reading it. And
was it the stress of the public performance, or was it more about the content of the poem itself, sort of being powerful? Or do you remember what was so emotional about it?
What might have been emotional about it, and I'm just speculating at this point because it was so long ago, because high school was a very long time ago, was likely a combination of the public speaking aspect, yes, the content of the poem, yes. But as I was telling that story, I remembered that I wrote a poem when we lived in California that I shared with my mom. And this was while my dad was actively abusing me. Like, that's the thing that was happening in the fifth and sixth grade.
Yeah.
And before that, and also after that, but it sort of was particularly hard in that time period. And so I wrote this poem that I don't remember, and I showed it to my mom. And my mom said that it sounded like a poem that someone else in our family would have written, and the person in our family that she named was someone who we knew had been abused by her dad. Mm. And so then I just, like, balled it up and threw it away.
Wow.
And so I think I just, like, had these sort of strange associations with, like, sharing work that it was...
Yeah. Well, and, like, the body, mm-hmm. like, lives in its own... It's its own brain. What am I trying to say? Like, you may not have consciously mm-hmm. known, like, poetry equals this, discovery equals mm-hmm. this feeling. Mm-hmm. But our bodies know, too. And again, like, poetry is writing, but it's also, like, breath and mm-hmm. beat. And it is very, like, physical and embodied. And so, yeah. And mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like you needed... to cry.
Sure, but just, like, not in the class.
I know.
Else, and everyone's like, and then I read the poem, and I don't think there was actually anything in the poem that would have, like, made sense for, like, me to be crying. And my teacher, who I've spoken to about this since then, felt so bad after. Like, she still remembered. It was like, and I was like, no, everything's fine. It all worked out. Yeah. Everything's fine.
So it's do okay. you feel like that was, I mean, was that a big moment for you or just a little moment? Like,
that was a little moment, okay. But in her class, she did ask us to write a lot of poems. So, like, one of our activities was to put together, like, a little, anthology or chapbook that was, like, a mix of our poems and other people's poems. And the poet I chose was Ogden Nash. And I don't know if y'all have read Ogden Nash, but, like, he has lots of what we would call now kind of, like, light verse about animals.
Love it.
Delightful.
Yeah.
So delightful. And so there was a lot of, like, his work. Like, I used a lot of his work and, like, sort of illustrated it with clip art.
A
lot of clip art.
Like, old school clip art.
Yeah. Good. Like, this was still the 90s.
Yeah.
So we still, it was just like, can I find an image of a clam that is in this Microsoft Word file, you know?
So, like, poetry comics right there. She was doing them very early.
Yeah.
So. And I wouldn't go so far as comics. Right. Slightly illustrated.
Yeah. Illustrated. Yeah. Like the books you love.
Yeah.
So,
like that.
So was writing at this point still hard for you? Like, not hard for you, but was it still something you didn't like to do?
Say yes. I didn't like it, but I did enjoy being affirmed.
Okay.
Right.
And I got a lot of affirmation. My essays, any, like, short stories that I was writing, anything that I was writing, people were just, like, so supportive. Like, this was at school primarily. People were so supportive, so interested. They would read anything, which was great, like, anything that I handed them. So at some point in high school, I started writing what we might call now self-insert fan fiction, which I didn't know anything
about. What does self-insert mean? Yeah, well, I don't know what that means.
So it's like, there was a character that was me.
Yeah, you're the hero.
Okay. You're right, but it was like Xena fan fiction. So it was like, I was like Xena, and then my friend PJ was like Gabrielle.
Yes.
And then, like, the villains were some of the teachers, which some of them really liked. Like, they were,
That's flattering to be written
about. So the students are reading these,
Just the teachers. It was just like, my friend PJ, and then the teachers.
That's so good.
And the teachers are so tickled, and they were so encouraging. I don't have any of this, I don't think, remaining, thank goodness.
I remember writing X-Files fanfic, and I wasn't Mulder or Scully, but I got to hang out with them. Mm. I was like the third FBI agent, I think. Mm,
okay.
And I would write it, and then I'd act it out in my room.
It's like a screenplay.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. All right.
Okay, no shame.
No shame. Yeah. All right, cool. Okay.
I mean, so many of the students here, like the way that they get started writing is with fan fiction.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's so funny. Because I don't think they expect anyone who is not 20 to know what fan fiction is, even though fan fiction is, what, as old as the original Star Trek?
Right.
Like, I think that's, like, one of the Genesis.
Is it? Okay.
It's, like, the Kirk-Spock fan
fiction. I don't know how far. I've never asked myself how far back it goes.
Was it Kirk and Spock being shipped?
Yeah.
Yes. That's
wow.
But there wasn't internet.
But they found ways to share it.
Yeah,
which is... Because people will share their fan fiction. They will find a way to do it.
Maybe were they mailing it to each other?
Something.
Yeah. I think there was mailing.
Yeah. That's great.
And it's wild to me that we somehow, I don't know, like I'm not look down on fanfic, but we don't consider it, I don't know, like high literature. And it's changing daily in my mind. Like this is, you are actually creating worlds and you are writing.
I feel like the Brontes were doing fan fiction when they were writing that whole sort of world when they were little
right.
kids.
Or they were just writing, gossip columns.
Like it's got to go way back. Yeah. But. So is the poem that you're going to read today, mm-hmm. does that sort of, is it a poem from this era or are we still have a ways to go?
It is from this era.
Yeah. Arkansas High School.
Yeah. I remember the Thanksgiving break of my senior year. So I would have been 16. I just wrote a bunch of very small poems. I think this might be one of them because it says it is from the year 2000.
Okay.
Which I think would have just been that little weekend. And maybe like sort of the weeks after that. And so I wrote a bunch of little tiny poems. And the one that I will read is incredibly short. and then I printed them. I put them in columns, like on a page that was just like stand, like letter oriented. Two columns. And then I folded them in half. And then I just handed them to my teacher. I was just like, I wrote these poems. And then I handed them, and then they were like, these are great.
And it was like a book, right?
Yeah, it was sort of like a pamphlet.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Yeah,
oh,
like,
cool.
like a
I mean, you self-published.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. That's awesome. The teacher must have been thrilled.
I mean, so cool. They were supportive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because the poems are very sad, because I was very sad.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that was part of what brought me to poetry is that it did feel like I could have my feeling in some way that was, like, true. But it didn't take up a lot of room, which I think was like it replicated kind of like the dynamic inside of my family where I don't think my parents' moods and their feelings took up the most room and there wasn't a lot of room for our feelings as kids. And so I think it felt like a space where I could just be like, I'm really sad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm so, so sad.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder too, was it a type of escape as well?
I think it was like a release valve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, less an escape, but more like things were building up and they had to come out.
Had to come
and
out.
And the Xena self-insert fanfic was insufficient.
Right. It wasn't
right,
working
right,
anymore.
Right.
It wasn't. Well, I mean, I was still doing that, just to be clear. Like, that did not stop. That stopped after high school. But I think it was definitely... it was just like a different register.
Right.
You know?
I mean, do you feel like at that age you were writing for the poems to be seen or you were writing for yourself?
So again, so now that's been 20, oh God, math is really bad. Like 25 years? That's fine.
Yeah.
25 years ago.
We'll say that.
Not that
25
many.
Years ago.
Yeah, it's
totally
many.
Fine.
It's just a bunch of years.
Yeah, it's just a decade, two decades and a half.
Two decades and a half.
Yeah. I do see the replication of a pattern, which is like I do write for myself.
Oh.
Like it's for me first, but almost immediately I want to read it to somebody.
Yeah.
I want to share it with somebody. And the people who I felt safe sharing that work with were my English teachers.
Yeah.
And they were these just like, I don't know, white ladies in Arkansas.
Are you still in touch with? I mean, it sounds like you had a lot of really good teachers.
I'm in touch with some of them.
Okay.
Do they know that
they must be pretty excited? Yeah, they must be thrilled.
Yeah. I mean, that it was a really supportive space, and I feel really grateful for just like their willingness to say, yeah, that's good, keep going. Mm-hmm. They didn't offer a lot of feedback. They weren't like, here are some things you can do.
Right.
Right.
They were just like, that's good, keep doing it.
Were there other kids or other, you know, students who you sort of shared your poetry with or who wrote poetry who you felt like were sort of kindred spirits, or was this a very solitary occupation?
I would say in high school it felt pretty solitary.
Yeah.
We did have like a little lit mag, you know, and that might be too generous a term for what we were working with, but we had a little lit mag, and I found one recently, and my sister had written a poem that was about Julius Caesar.
Hmm.
So I think a lot of our teachers were like asking us to write poetry, like in response to, because I definitely had like poems that were in response to Macbeth.
Okay.
When we had Chiku Reddy on, he remembered that one of his first poems was just an acrostic of the name Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, that's right. It was like his hero.
And he was in Chicago, so of course. Like,
he had a good teacher, too, yeah.
But yeah, like historical figures, mm-hmm. like let's mm-hmm. learn through writing, that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
And when I lived in Compton, we had pretty robust Black History Month programming.
Yeah.
And so we were reciting poems as a part of Black History Month. I recited a poem that I can't find anymore, but I do remember the first part of it. But I don't know who wrote it or where it's from, but it was like a part of our Black History programming. And I played Shirley Chisholm. Sure. there was a whole wig.
You memorize the poem?
Well, because I had to. That was my part in the.
That's awesome.
So, you know, I think I was
That's in hard to do.
Environments where
yeah.
that was like what was expected of us, right? It's like, oh, yeah, of course, you'll memorize some poems or, you know, you'll write in response to other kinds of literature.
That's great.
And, yeah, in L.A. and in Arkansas, I feel like I had really robust, education in literature. And I wouldn't say the arts because, like, again, in L.A. and Compton, there wasn't any money for the arts. But they did what they could, you know.
Yeah.
More so, there was more arts education in Arkansas because there was more money. But
did you loved reading illustrated books. Do you draw, too? Or
I did draw.
You did?
And
okay.
I've taken drawing classes as an adult, and that's worked out. I mean, like, we have a bunch of stuff in the house. That's
awesome.
I mean, it's not up, but it's in the house.
Yeah,
it's located. It continues to exist in the house.
It's working its way towards the walls.
Maybe.
Slowly. Maybe.
I have these really great cows that I painted. It's been about 10 years ago now.
Ooh, nice.
Just like really, really, really high quality, great cows.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just
oil,
some of the
were the oil or?
Watercolor.
Watercolor.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is also very like children's
book-esque. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we should. I think we should hear the poem before we go too far, because
that's true.
I'm always worried we'll run out of time when we haven't heard the work yet.
Yeah, no, but I think that's great.
Do you remember where you used to do your writing? Did you write?
Oh,
you
just kind of, in the dining room where the computer was.
Okay. Okay.
Did you have a shared family computer?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, there was just the one.
So you just kind of camp out in the dining room. Were you like a regular writer or just sort of periodically you would?
I've always been a periodic writer.
Okay.
Yeah. But like I would say starting from probably this time period. So like my, you know, like late-ish, mid-late-ish teens mm-hmm. until my MFA program, I just produced a lot of work. So, like, when I sat down to write, and I would write a lot.
Yeah.
But all the poems would be really small. So I was, like, a small poem writer. And the piece that I'm going to read, I need to tell you about my storage situation.
Okay. Oh, that's okay. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, storage.
Storage,
like...
yeah. Okay. File storage.
Oh, file storage. Okay.
I need to tell you about file storage. So... I saved everything, on the hard drive, but I understood, and part of this is because my mom was interested in computers, I understood that, like, something could happen to the hard drive, so you always want to have your things backed up, so I would back things up on, you remember the little, like, floppy, no, they weren't floppy
The zip
disks.
Drives, or?
Not a zip drive, it was the 3.5-inch disk.
Oh, of course,
was
yeah.
Was it a square with a circle in it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't the big square, it was the little one that had sort of the thing that slid over.
Do you remember? Oh,
yep,
yes.
Yep. Yeah, those last forever.
Yeah, metal. They did not.
They did
also
not.
Corruptible, which I found out in college kind of a lot. But
oh, no.
I would just like back up. I just like had lots of backups of my poems. And
you're an archivist.
Smart, yeah.
I mean, in only with only one thing.
Yes.
Which is
were you backing up onto those same discs or different kinds of things?
Well, I had like multiples of those discs.
Okay.
And then when flash drives became a thing, and I don't know if you remember, flash drives used to have like
I do, yeah.
Like 5 megabytes of storage or something. It was just like so small.
Right.
But I would as soon as those came on the market, those felt so much more stable. So I then moved all of the poems that were on disk onto the flash drives. But then, you know, you can lose a flash drive, so you need more than one flash drive. At any rate, right now I have cloud storage, which is located on my computer. So I save everything to my computer. It gets uploaded to the cloud. And it's just like all of the poems. I don't remember when I decided to do this, but all of the poems are organized by year.
Whoa.
So all the stuff that was on the disks and on the flash drives is on the cloud.
Yeah, and also on my computer.
So you're just constantly backing up.
Right, like, because something can happen.
Yeah.
I can't
do it for anyone else. I'm not even, it's not even clear to me how I've done it for myself, but.
Yeah. That's amazing. I love
but
it.
But so I have poems from the year 2000.
So good.
And there's just like a folder that says like 2000, 2001. I like to show it to my students so that they, most of them now are like, oh, you've been writing longer than I've been alive. I'm like, that's right. I've been writing longer than you've been alive. So let's relax. Everything will be fine. Yeah. And I'm like, I have hundreds of poems with like that. There's nothing to do with them.
Right.
I love them. At every poem that I wrote, at basically every moment that I wrote it, I was like, I'm a genius. This is so good.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a year later, I would be like, ooh, she was working hard. She was trying.
Do you feel bad about those poems that don't make it into a book? Oh,
no.
Okay.
No.
That's better than me.
No.
I don't. I feel guilt. I feel like they're mad at me.
No.
Okay.
No.
I
think
work
for
on
me,
it.
I think for me, and I am going to read the poems like right
yes.
after.
Yes. Yeah.
The thing for me is that like all of these poems were practice. Mm. Like they were a part of a practice. Like they weren't practice themselves, but they were a part of a larger practice. And I didn't understand that at the time. At a certain point, my skill set developed, and so then there wasn't necessarily anything to go back and change about those poems because those poems had done the work that they needed to do, and they sort of remain a kind of artifact or archive of where I was, how I was thinking, how I was feeling. And so to return to them feels both terrifying because it's like I literally don't understand how I get from this poem to like where I am now. Like there's not a clear trajectory except maybe a consistency in feeling and a desire to write things that are interesting. And my poems became more interesting as I read more interesting people and just read different kinds of poems and just have more experiences and gave myself permission to take up space. And
you have to write those first ones to get to where you are there.
Yeah, or the first critical. Like, you know, 500 or whatever. You got to write them. You know?
Yeah,
you
for
gotta,
sure.
You got to
sure.
put your hours in at the gym.
You do.
You know, you got to do the drills.
Clock in, clock out.
Yeah. And it's, and I don't know that that necessarily in and of itself is the thing that like made me a stronger writer, but it connected me, like the process itself became an integral part of how I process experience and feeling. And so I just feel really grateful to that. So like when I think about those poems, I'm like, oh, she was trying to figure things out, right? Like she figured out some things.
This is good.
I love it that you're framing it like that because I think it's so important for young writers especially to understand how much writing goes into that whatever final piece of writing you actually see, whether it's hundreds of poems or hundreds of pages of fiction. You know, a lot of stuff is just the, you know, the path by which you arrive at whatever ends up being on the page.
All right, so it was hard for me to find something to share with y'all. But I read this, and I was like, oh, I kind of did it. Like, that's the...
Cool.
Okay, so this is called Alter, A-L-T-E-R, Alter. My alter person, not afraid of the asinine, rarely taken in by the artifice of man. Love that line break. Brave, courageous, independent, and undependable, sometimes. Captor of the elusive confidence that lacks hubris and is unhesitant to be.
What? Wow. When did you write this?
Wow. I must have been 16.
Wow.
Oh,
so since it's so short, could you read it again?
I need to hear it again.
I will.
I just,
this is like light torture.
I mean, this
it's
is
totally
this is
fine.
Not it's not something we usually get to do.
Can I look at it real fast?
Yeah, of course.
And where is that line break? I'm just curious.
The line break is here. After artifice. Oh Oh my gosh. Okay. It's such a cute small poem.
So
it looks
so
beautiful.
Small. Wait, hold on.
So
I'm going to show you, like, if we just, like, imagine it on a page. Like, it's
I love
so small.
It,
it's so much bigger than its actual size.
So two,
yeah.
4, 6, 8, 10, 11 lines.
Yeah.
A number of the poems in Bestiary are 11 lines. I just, like, I'm like, oh, this is so nice. It's like,
right.
I was,
you can do a lot in 11 lines.
I was looking
lines.
For some
yeah.
shapes.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I wasn't looking for anything. I
appreciate a small little poem. I
yeah.
love a poem.
I'd love to hear it again.
All right.
Sorry to torture you.
Well, it's just because it does. There's not.
It's beautiful.
I
think
can
it's
talk
really
about
beautiful.
Like what's
yeah.
not in here, but what I really like about it. And
yeah, yeah. We'll
I
talk
want
about
to share
that.
It
yeah,
is,
yeah.
We'll talk about it. So
yeah.
I'll read it one more time.
Okay.
So, altar. My altar person, not afraid of the asinine, rarely taken in by the artifice of man, brave, courageous, independent, and undependable sometimes. Captor of the elusive confidence that lacks hubris and is unhesitant to be.
Dang, man. How did you know the phrase artifice of man?
Who knows?
I love the confidence.
I was in AP English.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
we were reading.
Like, I still
I love the confidence that lacks hubris. Man.
I like the sometimes.
It's incredible.
I am undependable. I am like, I'm a bit unreliable. I felt like I was like, oh, this describes my life in a lot of ways.
Like, so, right I nailed now, it.
I did it.
So what do you feel like, I mean, I could make guesses, but what do you feel like is happening in this poem for you personally? Like, mm-hmm. do you feel like are you exploring a version of yourself that maybe you weren't able to enact and sort of off the page? Or were mm-hmm. you sort of trying to work your way towards a new version of yourself? Or
so I think what was happening was likely... or what I read into the poem, what I see happening in the poem is a person who's trying to imagine into a different way of being. Mm-hmm. And that's been one of the really big things that my poems have allowed for is it's like I see a glimmer of something that feels possible, but it's possible. It's not happening. It's like it could happen. And then in the poem, it's like I sort of like, I don't know, fix it in space to mm-hmm. say, like, this is something that is possible.
Yeah.
And then when I look back, it's like that was a moment that inflects, right? Like, oh, I could do something different. I could choose to. So I can tell you a few things, like if I'm looking at the poem. Independent and undependable. I think it's like sometimes.
It sounds so good. I love the
yeah,
undependable
yeah.
is like kind of a strange. Like, that's not a – I don't think that's a word.
It's a word.
But I don't think it's actually...
Undependable?
Undependable. But I like I that know. I was just like, what if I just
yeah.
do whatever I want to do?
Right. And I mean, poets, you make words.
You yeah. said we. I think you...
We.
Yeah.
If anyone's allowed to, it's poets, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we just like...
And the ones who make words.
And I love the way it goes words. With independent. I mean, you kind of needed it.
And I think yeah. in my family, there was just like the codependency
yeah.
was so intense. And also... It was like this sort of codependency that was also undependable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was just like, is there a way to do something that is a little bit different, right? To be independent, which was almost impossible to imagine at that point, being 16, and not really having a plan for the future. Like, there was no future that I was imagining.
And that was your last year of high school, you mm-hmm. said, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're like kind of, you're pretty young to be in your last year of high school.
Yeah,
right?
I have an early... I have a late birthday.
Okay.
That, I don't know, I skipped a grade early. It doesn't matter. It doesn't.
No,
literally
I mean, I'm just
but
thinking
it
that
does
it's...
put me like in a kind of a weird space. So
yeah.
I start college when I'm 17. But I think I didn't have a plan. I just assumed, honestly, that I would be dead by the time I was 18.
Yeah.
Like, why?
That was the plan. Yeah.
But it wasn't like an active plan. I was
right.
just like, I
yeah.
couldn't possibly be
Picture
asked
yeah.
to continue living.
Right.
Wow.
And yet I continue to be alive. It's been 25
yeah.
years. So, you know, it's – so poetry became a way of, like, making sense of things, I think.
There's so much in those two words, independent and undependable. And I feel like it connects back – I feel like in a lot of your work, there's this idea that a thing can be two things at the same time, right? There's a duality where in some of these poems, a thing can be both dark and hopeful. The
mm-hmm.
thing can be both a beast and human.
Mm-hmm.
And it also makes me think, like, you know, like I had a family member, like, where I kind of hated him, but then he also did really good things. You know what I mean? And like, I feel like poetry is a place where that can exist. Mm-hmm. That and therapy, where you're like, can these things both be true at the same time? Mm-hmm. You know? And it took me a really long time to get, I mean, I think we've talked about it
before. A little bit, yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, poetry or writing in general is a place where you can really explore that in a way that's fruitful and effective, where, you know, and maybe you can't explore it everywhere else in the world.
Well, I think in narrative or in, like, in fiction or in certain kinds of essay writing, I think there's an impulse towards foreclosing, right? You have to, like, make choices that exclude things,
right?
Exactly. To tell a story. Like, to tell an enjoyable story, you have to leave a lot out. Mm-hmm. To have an enjoyable poem, you are also, like, we also have to leave a lot out. But the what I like to think I'm leaving out a lot of the time is the story. Right? I'm just like, what is the feeling? And so I don't have to ask, can these two things exist at once? I'm like, these two things exist at once. How does it feel?
And it actually ends up being more true because most of the world is two things existing at the same time or multiple.
Multiple things existing.
Wow. Right? And most of like love is that. Yep. I don't want to get like too
sentimental. No, my head is exploding here. So, I mean, yeah. I mean, I think what you're saying is that you know, narrative imposes a need to kind of resolve or finalize, whereas in poetry, you really don't, if you're not writing a narrative poem, you really have the freedom to sort of just put the things in juxtaposition and let them be there and not, which is so much more real or truthful or, yeah.
Well, and I don't think it has to be more or less than. It's just like its own thing.
Yeah, right?
Like, I think because there's such deep pleasure in story.
Right.
True.
Right? There's story's how we learn.
But so much never resolves. Like, you know, if you're thinking about your relationship with a relative, whether they're alive or not, that's problematic. I mean, there's never really, like, that story never ends.
No.
It's always just continually there to explore. And
And narrative is like, it's sort of tricky because it also can't really resolve. They lived happily ever after.
Until the next day.
I know.
Well, it's just like, but what is that? Like, what is happily ever after? Like, what is the ever after? It's like, we don't spend time with that part because there's not time to spend time with that part, right?
They live forever in unresolved.
You should write a book that starts with happily ever after.
I will not.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not going to either. Okay.
So
Stephen will have to do it.
When you look back at this poem, what excites you? There's plenty there that I can see, but what's pleasurable for you looking back and reading that? Like, what makes you excited?
The first thing that comes to mind
besides the line break.
I mean, the line break is very pleasing.
it's a good one.
It is. It's really good.
I really like the first line. The first line is my alter ego, period. Where it's just like, okay, sure. Okay, that's where we are. That's where we're about to enter into. I really like the diction. It's just like, it's so, I just like feel how I'm like reaching for language and like not afraid to have the wrong word. Because I'm assuming all of the words are correct. That's just being a high schooler. But just like the pleasure of like multisyllabic, polysyllabic words.
Love it. Delicious.
It's just, it's so delightful.
I mean, you can feel the delight in language that you already had.
Yeah. I mean, I've always loved, I mean, I think that was like when there was pleasure in writing, that pleasure came through the language.
Yeah.
Like when it felt exciting. It was not like, oh, here is my reading of the Scarlet Letter.
Right.
Which was like totally fine. It was more like, what are the words that I can use to like talk about this? Like, that feels fun.
It's absolutely playful too. You can, you know, like what you're doing with the words, you're experimenting, but I mean, I can tell you're having fun writing it.
I think it's also reaching for, again, like the reach for the future. And when I look back at it, because I was like sort of looking through these poems, sort of like squinting, like not allowing my eyes to completely close.
Right, right.
Because mostly I think it's not my business what I was up to when I was 16. That's her business and it's private. But I when I came across this one, which is like pretty early in the folder because it is in alphabetical order, and all of the file names, just as an aside, and this is in case there are any students listening. All of the file names are the titles of the poem, so they're very easy to find.
Yeah.
Find, yeah, yeah.
So they're ordered by year in the folders and then alphabetically. And
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good system.
The librarians
Yeah. I mean, just like, how do you find your things if you don't?
Isn't that like in the back of a big, I have some old like poetry collection at home. Mm-hmm. And it's at the very end, there's like an index of first lines, right?
And sometimes there's an index of titles.
Yeah.
Okay.
If it's a really big collected, I think I was just looking at Lucille Clifton's collected, and I think there's an index of first lines.
Right.
And also titles.
Yeah.
So, because when somebody has a lot of poems, how are you going to
find it?
At any rate. The other thing is, it feels like this young person who I feel very grateful to was like helped put me on the path that I'm on, right? So I think it's like, here is what we would like to do.
Yeah.
Like, this is the kind of person we would like to be. You know, it's just like cool with like regular stuff. Like independent, somewhat reliable, maybe not the most. I feel like it's good to be just like a little bit unreliable.
Well, also, I wonder, I mean, I don't want to like read too much into it, but you know, when you're a 16-year-old, you should be allowed to be a little undependable. Like, you know, other people should be dependable, and you should.
I like these shoulds. Yeah. I don't know what world.
I know. Right? So I can see how a longing for a little bit of freedom to be undependable would totally make
especially
sense.
Especially if you were like needed in a way emotionally or by other adults in your life and you're a child, the longing to just be undependable and free of that
because
responsibility.
Because that really is sort of what independence is in some way, is having the freedom
it's
to
not
be
being,
unreliable.
Yeah,
to say like, I might not be there.
Sorry, guys.
And also like to be confident, but like not a jerk. And also like not so confident that I bring about my own ruin, you know?
Right. I'm 16, I'll just use the word hubris.
Well, so you know, again, impressive. AP English, Beowulf.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that's senior English. Yeah. We read Beowulf.
Yeah.
That was a big part of that.
Right. Okay. So when you're looking, when you say that it's hard to trace your way forward from this to sort of where you currently are, what makes you say that? Like, what is it that you, what feels to be missing, or how would you explore that? Not that it has to connect.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I think it's a good question. I mean, at that point in my life, I didn't know that anybody could be a poet. I definitely thought poets were a thing in the past and not a thing that one could do.
They're only in AP English.
Right, or any other English class.
Right,
And I didn't have like the students here at Iowa, like they come in and they're like, I'm going to write a book. And I was just like, I'm gonna write poems. Writing poems is fun.
Right.
Like that was like my basic energy was, or like I feel really sad and this is where the sadness goes.
Yeah.
But also it's fun. That felt really important. But I wasn't thinking there is a career on the other side of this. I wasn't thinking about having a book. I didn't know like any of the things that were possible. And so I wasn't writing in a way that was focused towards like any ultimate goal. It really was just like, what am I interested in? What kinds of things can I write that will keep me interested?
Mm-hmm.
And like in the writing, like
yeah.
what can I write that will keep me interested in what I'm writing? And it wasn't until my junior year, the summer between my junior and senior year of college, when I went to what is now called the Bucknell Seminar for Undergraduate Poets, where I met the poet Terrence Hayes, and this was just, this was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Terrence said, you should go to an MFA program. And I was like, what is that?
Yeah, right.
And I just like think about that with my students where they just like they come in and
they
know so much.
Know.
Like I didn't know anything. And I think even in the MFA program, I didn't know anything.
Yeah.
And was it wild like meeting a living poet too? Like someone who was actively doing it?
I mean, yeah. But what was he doing? Like it wasn't legible to me, you know?
Yeah, you're right.
It was like he was just like another teacher, you know?
Right.
It wasn't like, oh, here is like Terrence. Like now it's like, oh, it's Terrence. Like Terrence,
right.
Capital T.
Yeah, yeah.
MacArthur Genius Grant winner, you know,
right?
Who, when I see him, it's like I've known him since I was 20.
Wow,
you know, so it's like, oh, it's Terrence, but also it's like, oh, it's Terrence, and that difference. I guess I just sort of like winding my way around to the question is that the steps that I've taken in my growth as a poet has meant that I've like had to figure out what feels interesting to me, who's doing the kind of thing that I like to read, yeah. Can I do what they're doing, but without necessarily like a goal. Like there was a point, I think after the MFA, I was like, well, I would like a book. I think it would be nice to have a book. But I wasn't like, and then I'll get a job and then I'll do this and I'll do this. I was just like, yeah. It'd be nice to have a book. And I think it was just so much not knowing. Like I just didn't know anything.
And you, like it was an uncertainty, but it seems like you just...
Well, there was... What else was there to do?
I know, right?
Also not hard. I will say this just to circle back to the beginning. Like none of the steps that I took felt hard. Like they all felt available and reasonable. So mm-hmm. I got a PhD after I got the MFA. Yeah. I would say of my dissertation process, the part that was hard was actually just sitting down and doing the writing. The writing itself was somewhat torturous because I don't like writing prose. That's a lot of connective tissue.
Yeah.
You have to, it's like 200 pages of just words.
And then you have to fill the whole
you
page.
You have to fill the whole page. It's horrible.
Bummer. What was your dissertation on?
Oh my God. My dissertation was on representations of white men in contemporary American Westerns.
Okay.
Because I wanted to finish. I didn't want to write a dissertation that would have me in my feelings.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Right.
Because I had poetry and I could explore my feelings over there. And I do feel like it's like there was a way every so often I wish that I had made a closer study of Black literature, like Black American literature. But I also realized like I can just do that in my life and it doesn't I don't have to write 200 pages about it. Like I can teach it.
I would love to read the dissertation about
it's that. Not it's not gonna come from me. Someone else has done it. Many other people have done it. But I do think that there is this way that like I was like, what will make this easier mm-hmm. to get through? And that was the dissertation that did it. My feelings were not caught up.
Yeah. Right, no, I meant that I mean no. I would love to read either one of the dissertations.
No. But
I'd love to read the John Wayne dissertation
it's a good dissertation in that it is done. Like that is the way that it is good. Yeah, but I'm not a prose writer.
Yeah.
Like it's not in my heart. It's not in my spirit.
I was just gonna say, so what I'm hearing a little bit, tell me if this is correct, is like you didn't know necessarily what the steps were that you would have to take, but was that sort, and you were very focused on just writing about what interested you. Do you think that was, looking back on it, was like good for you, like healthy, not to be really sort of preoccupied with, you know, getting to all the steps and hitting all the rungs and just kind of being focused on where you were and letting the next thing mm-hmm. come naturally?
The thought I had was, well, here I am.
When yeah, well, yeah,
I
right.
Had, there was a poet who said, poetry is her securest attachment.
Mm.
And when she said that, I was like, yes, this is my securest attachment.
Mm.
There is no other thing in my life that has been as reliable as poetry. Mm. And so because it is like deeply embedded in my life, it's so richly embedded in my life. I feel really grateful to have a readership. I feel really grateful to have this job. I get to teach young people. I love working with students. Like I've worked with non-majors. I've worked with majors. I've taught intro to gender studies. I've taught, you know, it's just like I like working with undergrads. I think it's a really fun age stage of life, an inquiry into self and just trying to figure things out. And at the same time, when I sit down to write, it's not for any of that. It's just, oh, it's time to write. It feels like it's the release valve or I want to make something. I want to go play. Mm-hmm. And it's a place where I can go play. I think not having that attached, like not having that idea of poetry as a professional goal
right.
has meant that it has been, it's a kind of avocation that is also a vocation.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like, it's my true work. It's like my real work, but it's also, it's like all mine.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah.
And it's sort of, it seems like the writing led you instead of you pushing the idea of I'm going to be a writer, you know, the writing pulled you along the whole way. And that's, I love that, to find the ease in things that you do and that path is much more glowing,
mm-hmm.
I suppose. I don't know what I'm saying.
No, I think, I like it too.
That feels right.
You have a new book coming out.
I do.
And coming out October 7th. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's available for pre-order.
It is. It's available for pre-order from Prairie Lights.
Yeah, and I will put that link in here.
Yeah. And anyone who orders from Prairie Lights, if they want it signed, I mean, it's cool. It's the local bookstore, so it's easy to sign.
Yeah,
easy to sign things.
Do you see any connections between the writing that you were doing and at 16 and what you're doing today?
I do. I do see those connections. I mean, I think a lot of the subjects are the same.
Yeah,
you know, that's sort of reaching forward, reaching into the future. And I think while you were talking, Lauren, I was thinking about this thing that is true in my family, which is that everyone makes some kind of art in my family. Like, even if it's like little drawings, like my dad does little drawings sometimes, or he did when I was a kid. My brother can do anything. Genius. He's a horrible person. He's a genius. I wish he were better. My sister and my brother, when I was in the MFA program, one of the things that they were doing back in Arkansas, because I was in Texas, is they were just like making music. Mm. And then they would burn the songs onto CDs, because that's what we did back then. And then my mom would play the CDs in her car. Like, they would play the CDs in their car, like driving around. My niece and my nephews all do the same thing. It's like, oh, you can just like make music. Like you can just like write a song. Yeah. And then record the song and then listen to the song. Like, these are all things that are available. And through that, like, making music in particular, it's been a place where I've heard them expressing feeling. And so I just, I come from a family that does that, which feels really interesting, because it's like I'm doing it in this way that sort of has a institutional recognition. But I love the way that my family is like, we recognize ourselves.
Yeah.
And this is important. And so in the natural order of things, one of the first movements in the collection is one that is just my family's language, which is, I find really, really beautiful. Like, in particular, the Arkansan side. I don't know my dad's side of the family as much. And his parents were from Chattanooga, which is also rich. It's also rich language. But my mom's side of the family, and that's the side of the family that I spent the most time with, just like really, really gorgeous language.
Huh.
And so in some ways, what I see happening when I'm 16 is like this desire to sort of run away. It's sort of what I've come back to is like, what are the ways that I can come closer to my family? What are those routes that feel possible?
Right. Like, so you were trying to create distance, but...
And I did. And that was successful. And that was successful.
Yeah.
And now you're realizing that the beauty you saw in...
Yeah. Now I can come closer.
That's cool.
Right. Like, now there's room to come closer. And I think a lot of like... I'm a depressive. It's just strong. It's strong in me. I just skew in that direction. That was in a lot of the poems that I was writing when I was a teen into my 20s, and obviously in these books, the other books that I've written. But it feels hopeful, and I want to read the last poem in this book.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because I feel like there was a seed planted, like, with this poem that I read, Alter, and then it's like, oh, wait, here I am.
Yeah.
Like kind of doing those things.
I'm so glad you remembered that.
I wasn't gonna forget to read my own poem.
This is the goal too. Like, this, I love it. Like, we're gonna see the progression, we're gonna see the string.
Yeah.
Do you know internal family systems?
I do. You know Melissa's mom.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's part of like the kind of concept I've had behind the podcast, and what you're doing right now is like, we're gonna connect 16-year-old you with present day you, and
Not too much pressure though, Lauren.
No, it's not, we'll see. It's the ease. It's the flow.
Well, yeah, here we are.
Okay.
We are.
I love it.
Okay.
And here we are.
Cool.
So this poem I wrote when I lived in Western New York, and that was definitely a sad time living in Western New York. I made some good friends there. I was teaching at St. Bonaventure University. That was actually the place where I wrote most of the poems for the Renunciations. But I also wrote this poem alongside. And if you'll recall earlier, I was like, I didn't expect to be alive past the age of 18. Right. This also connects to that. So this poem is called Suicide Watch Spring. So much has happened that I would never have known I could remember. The trees here budding red before they flower, the hills scraped with rust before white, before petal, before green. The old dog sprayed by a skunk last fall, carrying the burning oil in his ruff, there still if you breathe deeply enough. Last night, the raccoon frozen mid-lane before my headlights, that I whispered, get along, little friend, to its flashing eyes, my rummaged heart. Reading, always in the sun, always my chest a sail belled with my own words, with every breath on stage. Loving you in the dark, some small animal in the grand scheme. loving you in the morning, the light breaking like a heart over the plains of our bodies, some small planet in the grand scheme, that I'm happy sometimes to be alive, that such happiness could have happened at all.
That's so good. Wow. I cannot wait for this book.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. My rummaged heart.
And I read that, I was like, what's that?
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think your 16-year-old self, I mean, if you showed
my 16-year-old self is baffled by my life. Yeah, so
right. You've already talked to her.
We've checked in, right.
It is
you don't need a podcast to check in with your...
But it is a life that is so different from what I had, what felt possible and what felt known. Mm-hmm. And so much of that has come out of writing poetry. Like, the writing itself is the practice of writing, the sort of keeping it connected to what feels important to me, what feels interesting to me, the integrity that I bring to my work has led to a life filled with integrity, which just feels like I couldn't have called it, as we would say. Like, I couldn't have called it. It feels really remarkable meeting my wife.
Yeah.
Well, second wife, which is, she teases me about that. But like, she read Bestiary and reached out.
That's awesome. Wow. I didn't know that's how you met.
Yeah, wow. That's how we met. Wow. And I had already read her first book and her essays and had watched the TED Talk. And so I was ready. I didn't have to get ready. I was already ready.
Wow. But you, at every step of the way, you're writing yourself into existence in this strange way.
And reassuring myself of my existence.
Yes.
You know, so.
And I love that you brought up integrity, because there are times, a lot of the time, when I think that that is like the most rare and valued quality in people. Like, just, it just seems so rare to have integrity, and so few people seem to actually be aspiring or working towards integrity, and it's a beautiful thing to see valued and, you know, sought after.
Well, we are reaching the end of our time here. I cannot wait for this book to come out. Again, pre-order Prairie Lights, mm-hmm. And we will put the link in there. And thank you so much.
Anika, thank you so much.
This was so fun.
Support for this podcast comes from the University of Iowa, the Magid Center for Writing, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Graduate College. We'd like to thank the Center for Language and Culture Learning for use of their podcast studio. Sad Me of the Past is part of the Writing University Podcast Network at the University of Iowa. This network includes podcasts from creative writing programs and departments all across our campus. Visit writinguniversity.org/podcasts to see our full list of offerings, including Writing Matters, The 11th Hour, Origins, The Short Coat, and more.